This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. When you think of an ecosystem, you might think of the tropical rainforests of the Amazon or the icy tundra of the Arctic. But what about the concrete jungles of our cities? 54% of all people live in cities, according to the World Health Organization, and these cities have systems and dynamics that are unique to the urban environment. Scientists are just now understanding how all this works, and a special issue of the Journal of Biogeochemistry looks at just this. My next guests are both editors of that issue. Sujay Kaushal is an associate professor of geology at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Willie McDowell is the director of the New Hampshire Water Resources Research Center and professor of environmental science at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, New Hampshire. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
If you've got questions about the urban ecosystem, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Willie McDowell, I'm going to start with you. How can we really study a city in the same way we look at, say, grasslands or deserts or the jungle?
Well, basically, we can use the concepts of ecosystem ecology in which we try to establish boundaries and look at the inputs and outputs and internal transformations, the movements and changes in materials and energy in the system, and then examine how that changes over time and what the fate of those materials coming in and out of the city are.
Is it harder to do this in a place that's very, very populated with all sorts of other man-made systems going on at the same time?
Well, it is. That's one of the fundamental challenges that we identified in our overview paper, is that it's hard sometimes to draw those boundaries, and it's hard sometimes to understand how materials and water move through the system. And much of our focus, of course, has been on understanding the impacts on water quality. And so that hydrology is often very complicated, and that does pose some problems compared to many natural ecosystems.
And we're going to talk a bit about the water quality in just a moment. But in the paper, you also mention urban evolution. What does it mean, do you think, William, for a city to evolve over time?
Well, basically, it means that both the physical attributes of the city, as well as the social structures in the city, the way in which we manage things, and the inputs that come into the city, all of those things can change over time. And we haven't really had enough information until now to get beyond simply describing cities as sort of snapshot views. And now we have enough information that we can start to understand how they change over time, which is critical, of course, to understanding how we can manage and how we can improve things in terms of protecting environmental quality in cities and their immediate vicinity.
In your paper, Sujay, you outline a few traits of cities, and you talk about an urban karst. Can you explain what a natural karst is first?
Sure. In our overview paper, we wanted to bring attention to the fact that urban ecosystems have their own geology, and this is mainly due to concrete infrastructure, building materials used to build roads, buildings. In a natural system, karst, it can be a type of landscape made of limestone, rock material that basically dissolves with water and forms fissures, cracks, or even sinkholes or caverns. For example, you might have heard of karst geology in Florida. So what we thought was happening in urban environments was that basically we've imported a lot of limestone into these cities for building materials, and you get the same kind of landscape forming over time through basically the dissolving of these materials with rainwater.
The dissolving of the limestone by rainwater, I would assume rainwater that's got something in it to help dissolve it, right?
Right. For example, if you have rainwater in cities, in urban areas, that rainwater can be acidic due to acid rain. And so this acid rain basically falls on the built material and then dissolves it more quickly and more readily.
And so what are some of the other things that happen with this, Willie McDowell? So we get this dissolution of our buildings, the concrete over time. All of this happens because of rainwater and because of acid rain. And so what all happens to the water that are in these urban environments?
Well, it's important to remember that it's not just the acid rain. There are other factors that are contributing to the breakdown of the of the concrete structures. But basically what we see then is that between leaking pipes and breakdown of materials, we tend to see a pretty distinctive signature of urban waters that includes higher calcium levels often and also includes higher chloride levels. And so what we are seeing as these cities function is that the water quality changes pretty dramatically, and it appears fairly systematically in cities around the globe. And so that's one of the things we're trying to establish with this call for action in our paper.
And the water also, Sujay, is getting saltier along the way as well.
Right. As Bill just mentioned, in our paper, we looked at long-term trends in different rivers around the world, all around the world, and they showed the systematic pattern of salinization, where they're getting saltier over time. And what's interesting is that this was happening in rivers where they apply road salt in climates where it's cold and they use de-icers, but it was also happening in rivers and watersheds where they don't apply road salt. And so with the process of urbanization, you get this evolution of salinization that goes along with it, hand in hand, and that could be due to not only road de-icers, but also leaking sewage, septic systems, water softeners, and also the dissolving of rocks, and this urban karst can also contribute to salinity as well.
If you've got questions about our urban ecology, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Hello, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I guess I was just curious how you mentioned it a bit with, like, de-icers and stuff, but I guess I was wondering how you account for social and cultural factors in the structuration of urban space, especially when with regard to, like, you know, uneven distribution of resources, those sorts of things, because it seems like culture and social factors can have a huge impact on how space is structured and how resources are contaminated with, for example, salinization or pollution, things like that. So how do social factors and cultural factors play a role in all of this?
It's a great question. Sujay, why don't you tackle that one?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. In our overview paper, we actually do, as you say, and include people as part of the ecosystem, where people basically facilitate the evolution of these ecosystems in terms of form and the spatial variability that you're talking about. And one example, a direct example related to what you talk about, is the connectivity of impervious surfaces in a watershed. That can be related to social factors and planning. And so you can have these watersheds where they're increasingly connected by surfaces like parking lots, pavements, roadways, impervious surfaces where rainwater doesn't sink through them. And that can more efficiently transport pollutants like road salt into streams and rivers. However, based on human choice, and this is how we can influence urban evolution by selecting the traits of these watersheds and how we develop the land, you could imagine some areas of the country or the world where they choose not to connect, not to develop to this extent, and then also to not have these all these impervious surfaces connected to one another. And for example, in Australia, they're actually experimenting with not connecting these impervious surfaces. So when water comes out from a storm drain pipe, it can go into a grassy area before being connected to the rest of the hydrologic system. And also, even in older urban areas, they're now, due to social interest, for example, in old schoolyards in Baltimore and close to Washington, D.C., where I live, actually, they're breaking up some of these concrete areas that are basically not needed. And so they're reducing the impervious surface cover so that water can then infiltrate into the ground and then make it to streams more slowly. And there's a chance for some retention of these pollutants before they get to the water.
But there's also things like wealthier areas maybe having yards out in front and fertilizers, and maybe less wealthy areas having higher density. Does that affect the urban ecosystem?
Oh, definitely. We address that also in the paper, that basically there's a continuum of pathways in which water makes it into streams and rivers. And one common way that water makes it into streams and rivers is that it flows from areas outside the city that are suburban or low residential into areas that are more densely urban, and then so it moves from small streams and low residential suburban areas into larger rivers, which are more urban. So this has tremendous impacts on water quality, and we actually use a term in the paper called the urban watershed continuum, acknowledging this continuum of flow paths. What happens is that in some of these low residential suburban areas, you actually get higher levels of pollution than sometimes in the urban areas because of septic systems and groundwater contamination. And basically, we were trying to, as Bill mentioned earlier, we were trying to think of a systematic way to describe these different cities around the world, around the country. And so what you hit on is a very important example, but there are generalizable trends in some of these major cities that start off in suburban and residential areas, and then the spatial evolution of their water quality problems as they go into more urban areas. And another example is flooding, for example. You get these low residential and suburban areas outside of cities, and then one thing that we point to is that there's an expansion of storm drain networks, basically to drain these landscapes to prevent water from building up on people's lawns. Well, all this water has to go somewhere. Where does it go? It goes downhill, downstream, and then it leads to flooding in urban neighborhoods. So I remember a couple years ago, I was working with a colleague looking at urban flooding down in Baltimore, and these residents came out. And they asked, you know, is the city going to do something about our flooding? When is it going to help protect our playgrounds from being washed away? And basically, that's a symptom of all the urban development and expansion of urbanization outside of the cities, and then that expanded storm drain network.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're going to take some more phone calls here on urban ecology. Let's go to Amy, who's calling from the concrete jungle of Manhattan. Hi, Amy.
Hi. The guest mentioned acid rain before, and I thought we had taken care of acid rain, and it wasn't happening anymore. Am I wrong about that, or how much acid is in normal rain? Do we have normal rain anyplace?
Yeah, do we have normal rain? Thanks for the question. Willie McDowell, she thought we took care of acid rain. Isn't that all gone? No?
That's a very good point, Amy. And in fact, we have reduced the acidity of rainfall dramatically because of the effective implementation of the Clean Air Act and reduction of the acidic emissions emissions that cause the acid after chemical reactions in the atmosphere. So yes, we've reduced the atmospheric inputs of acid that can affect cities and, of course, natural ecosystems. But there still remains some acid in the rain, and of course, there's a natural acid in the rain, carbonic acid. The dissolution of CO2 in water makes carbonic acid, which is responsible for a lot of weathering in natural systems. So you're right, it's gone down, the acidity in rain, but it's still an important factor in driving ecosystem function, both in natural systems and we believe in urban systems as well.
Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Atlanta. Hi there, Matt.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I was reading something about the sinkholes in Guatemala City and how one of the causes contributing to that was deteriorating sewer pipes or other sorts of pipes underground. So I'm wondering if this is the same sort of thing could happen in a lot of different cities over the course of time.
It's a great question, Matt. Sujay, what do you say?
That's a very interesting question. In Baltimore, where we work, there was actually an incident where in a neighborhood, basically a street fell in and formed a sinkhole. You're right. There's a dense labyrinth of pipes that basically go underground and deteriorate over time. I don't want to make anyone alarmed as they're walking down their city street, but it is something that we need to take into consideration that we are on top of these dense pipe networks and they do deteriorate.
As we run low on time, Willie McDowell, I guess I'm wondering if you can maybe share some positives out of all this. I mean, what have we learned about the urban ecosystem and maybe some things that might help to make a better urban environment that we could start to implement in our cities?
Right. That's a really good point. What we see is that, in fact, urban systems do appear to be changing over time, and the fact that we see changes suggests that we can redirect those changes with some careful study and some innovative and insightful planning and paying close attention to how we maintain and build new infrastructure. And so that's our hope, that one of the outcomes of this new interest in urban ecosystems is that we'll be able to help planners and managers do a better job in terms of protecting the natural environment and the ecosystem services that any landscape can provide.
And Sujay, very quickly, a lot of people want to know, just more green spaces, if we had more parks, more biodiversity inside our cities, would that help us?
I think that would help us. I mean, these, as Bill mentioned, these cities evolve, and we can choose to a certain extent some of the trajectories or pathways in which they evolve.
Sujay Kaushal is an associate professor of geology at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And William McDowell is the director of the New Hampshire Water Resources Research Center and professor of environmental science at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, New Hampshire. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate being on.